Hey there, and welcome to another edition of The Journey of Hope. Glad you could be with us today. The Journey of Hope is a podcast that's especially designed to address the issues that men and women face after incarceration. Sean Atwood is our guest today. He's going to be calling in from London, England, and Sean has got a very unique story. You may have heard of Sean. Sean, at one time, was a big-time drug dealer in the Arizona area, ran into problems with the mob, and ended up in prison in Arizona, and has written books about his experiences, and is going to talk to us today about what life was like when he was coming out of prison and the things that he did to reintegrate, as well as his story. He's going to talk about his story today, which is very interesting. So we'll be right back with Sean after this. I'm Rodney Mathers, and you're on The Journey of Hope. Thank the wonderful people over at RadioGuestList.com. They asked me to do an on-air mention, so hopefully other people will use their service. RadioGuestList.com has provided me with guests over the years free of charge, and they believe in what I'm doing. They can do the same for you if you're interested in doing this sort of thing. That's RadioGuestList.com. Check them out. Everybody, and welcome back. My guest today is Sean Atwood. Sean made a great deal of money selling ecstasy and eventually got caught. He did time in Arizona. He has written numerous books. We're going to talk about those books here in a minute and give the exact titles, but he has told about his experiences. And Sean, it's great to have you on the show today. We're looking for ways to overcome adversity, and I think that you are a shining example of that. So thank you for being on The Journey of Hope today.
Why, thanks, Rodney. Yep, I put myself in Arizona's deadliest jail, so I quickly had to learn how to overcome adversity.
That's got that nut Arpaio down there, doesn't it? He's running the show down there.
Wasn't my brightest idea to get arrested when Sheriff Joe Arpaio was in charge of the local jail.
Oh my gosh. That dude is a total tool, man. But, you know, the thing about it is there are a lot of people that like him, which is scary, you know? But I just think he's a nut, and I think that you probably would agree with me. Let's start off, Sean, by just giving a little bit of your history. Tell us a little bit about, you know, some of these things that you went through, so we get a good idea of where it is you're coming from today.
Okay. Have you ever visited England?
I have not.
Well, I'm originally from a little town in between Liverpool and Manchester. Uh-huh. It was the industrial north, so I didn't grow up with much money, but I got interested in the stock market at a very young age, and I set my sights on becoming a millionaire in America. Mm-hmm. I achieved this by my mid-20s to late-20s. I was making six figures by mid-20s, and I was worth about $2 million at the peak of the dot-com bubble. But all the money went to my head because I had no emotional maturity and I had no common sense. So I started to throw massive rave parties with it. I had people importing ecstasy from Holland for me, smuggling it in. Mm-hmm. And I knowingly broke the law. America was good to me. I didn't need to be doing all this. I got addicted to the lifestyle, the attention, the drugs. And I went completely out of control. And that resulted in a SWAT team smashing my door down on May 16th, 2002.
Wow. Now, there's an interesting story. I believe I've got this right, that by time they were kicking your door down, you had quit doing this, right? I mean, you had kind of retired from the scene. Am I correct in that?
Yes, I'd met a woman I fell in love with, and she pointed out the dangers to us and our families and that kind of thing, and said it was selfish of me to be dealing. And I loved her so much, I quit about a year before the SWAT team came. But I was naive to the statute of limitations. Mm-hmm. I thought they had to catch you with the drugs. All it takes in Arizona is someone from your past within the previous 7 years to go to the police and say that you have sold them drugs and they've got you.
Wow. And the criminal justice system is really not very forgiving, is it? And so I'm thinking that there was another story as well where one of your employees got beat up real bad or something. It was one of the reasons why you decided to get out. Am I right about that?
Yeah. As I was rising up the ranks of the ecstasy dealing chain, I started to bump heads with some serious people, and one of them was Sammy the Bull Gravano, the underboss of the Gambino crime family. He set up an ecstasy dealing ring out of Tempe, Arizona, in competition with mine.
Mm-hmm.
And his goons one day, they grabbed one of my guys out of a nightclub, and they smashed his face in, knocked his teeth out, stole his money, stole his ecstasy. And they basically said they were coming after me next. So I actually fled from Phoenix to a house in Tucson in the Catalina foothills in a gated, guarded community because I was so scared of these guys,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the hope that they wouldn't find me up there, which they didn't ultimately. But Sammy the Bull's son told me later on in prison that he'd been dispatched one night to kidnap me from a nightclub and take me out to the desert. And the only reason we'd missed them that night was because my best mate, Wildman, had had a scuffle, and we'd had to leave that place in a hurry. So on the drugs, it was telling me, you're the man, this is fun, this is cool, you're living like in a character in a movie. But once I sobered up in the jail and looked back on the past 10 years, I was just like, oh my goodness, how on earth are you still alive?
Mm-hmm. What dates are we talking about here? Are we talking about in the 80s or 90s? When was all
okay,
this?
I arrived in Arizona in 1991, a penniless business 91. Graduate with just my mm-hmm. student credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
By the mid-90s, I was the top producer in the office, raking in hundreds of thousands a year. And then by the dot-com bubble, I ended up worth about $2 million in the stock market. I started dealing the ecstasy in about 96, 97 and throwing the raves. And that lasted for about 5 years. I quit a year before the SWAT team came, and that was May 16, 2002.
The reason I ask is, I got a little bit of a wild hair in my past too, but it seems like... I never did anything like that. I never dealt drugs or anything, but it seems like there was a time when the dealing of ecstasy was just kind of done out in the open in some clubs. It was not, I don't know. I think the clubs kind of encouraged it, you know?
It certainly took a long time for the authorities to catch up with it because some of my smugglers, they got in at Sky Harbor Airport with thousands of ecstasy pills in vitamin jars, and the people who inspected their luggage just took them out of the luggage, put the vitamin jars on a table, asked them what they were, and they said they're just vitamins and stuff, and then they put them back in the luggage and let them go.
Okay.
The other thing is to detect ecstasy, you've got to have specially trained beagle dogs. So people who carry pot very easily detect it because the dogs are trained for that, and mm-hmm. coke as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I warned all my smugglers, you know, don't go near any pot or don't go near any coke. And one of my smugglers didn't listen to me, and he was smuggling and he bought his best friend some weed in Europe, and they were in France, and the dog just walked right up to him and just put its paw on him, and he had 10,000 ecstasy pills on him.
Oh no.
And all got lost over $50 worth of weed.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Now, so we get through this time period in your life where you've made all this money, you've backed off the scene, and then here come the police. They finally caught up with you, and so you're in prison in Arizona. How much time did you do there?
Okay, in the beginning, I'm unsentenced for 26 months. I'm fighting my case.
Mm-hmm.
And the second year in, they tell me that I'm facing a maximum 200-year sentence.
Oh, my God.
Right from the very beginning, they had me classified as a serious drug offender with 25 years to life, and then they increased it to 200. So I was thinking I was never, ever going to get out. Mm. But fortunately, I was blessed to have such supportive parents. The police had took all my money, but my parents remortgaged the house, cashed in their retirement account, come up with $100,000 for Alan Simpson, who's a very good lawyer. And at the end of the day, you know, your sentence is determined by who your lawyer is and how much money you've got.
That's right.
So he got it down to 9.5 years. And as a first-time nonviolent drug offender, I ended up serving just under 6.
Okay. So how'd you like that?
It was the perfect amount. It was the perfect amount of time for me.
Yeah. I take it that, you know, you sound like a smart guy and an educated guy, and so that prison environment was not something you were accustomed to, I'm assuming. And so tell us a little bit about how your life changed in prison and what you had to deal with there.
Well, I'd seen The Shawshank Redemption, but you know, after a couple hours of that, you can just turn your TV off. When you're actually in there, and these things are really happening, it puts you in a complete and utter state of shock.
Yes.
So right away, I had to get used to the sounds of heads getting bashed against toilets, bodies getting thrown around. Saw one guy get carried out on a stretcher, looked like he was dead. There wasn't just blood coming out of his head, there was yellow fluid, like brain stuff coming out of his head. Mm-hmm. And the prisoners started coming up to me saying, you've got to get that look of shock off your face, or else you're going to be getting your head smashed against the toilet next.
Right.
So 6 months later, I've got what's called dead eyes. Even today, on my passport and driver's license photo, which was taken when I got out of prison, my face looks completely blank, mm-hmm. totally devoid of emotion, because if you show any sign of weakness, it's going to get exploited. You know, 6 months in, this violence was nearly every day. Mm-hmm. I'd seen people's teeth get knocked out, just bounce on the floor. I saw one guy's leg pointing in the wrong direction. I saw a mentally ill old man who was rambling all day. The gang decided to shut him up. And as I walked past him, blood just squirted out the back of his head. Mm-hmm. So you get immune to it. You get desensitized. And, you know, that after 6 months, these are the various stages of adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Did Arizona provide any way for you to get yourself together before you left? Did they do anything for you?
The remand jail didn't know where I was for 26 months. It was just complete drug and gang-infested mayhem. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that society rounded up mostly drug-addict criminals and put them where the hardest drugs were readily available. 90% of the prisoners were shooting up heroin and crystal meth.
Right.
Two-thirds had hepatitis C,
right.
sharing dirty needles. So as soon as you go in, the Aryan Brotherhood prison gang skinheads come up to me and they're like, hey, get in that cell back there. We want a word with you. And you know you can't say no to these guys.
Mm-hmm.
So I walk into the cell. They close the door. They got me trapped in there. Biggest one gets in my face. He's like, what are your charges? What are your charges? Now, you know, I'm new to this, and I've read my charge sheet, and it's all legal terminology. I have no clue what it means.
Mm-hmm.
So I say to the guy, I've read it, but I just don't understand my charges. He's like, what do you mean you don't understand your charges? You a chomo? So they've got me up against the wall, just about to smash me. I don't know what chomo is either yet. Chomo's child molester.
Right.
In the end, I pulled my charge sheet out, showed it to them, and they left me alone because I was in for drugs and nearly everybody is.
Mm-hmm.
But some charges are KOS by the gang, kill on sight, right. pedophile stuff.
Right.
And other charges are SOS, smash on sight, such as drive-by shootings because women and kids sometimes get hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so anyone coming in with a sex offense, crime against a woman or a kid, the gang right away is going to try and murder them. At the very least, they're going to smash them.
That's right.
And they're constantly looking for people to beat up because that's how they earn their tattoos. That's how they rise up in the gang.
That's right.
To be a full member of the neo-Nazi Aryan Brotherhood, you've got to murder someone in the jail for them.
That's right. I did 7 years here in Texas, and they approached me. And my story was a little bit different than your. When they approached me, I didn't want anything to do. I thought they were just as ignorant as anybody else in there. I didn't want anything to do with them. And but it's hard to say no. But my wife is Hispanic. And when my wife came up there to visit me the first time, after they saw her, they just left me alone. They didn't want me no more. Thank God.
Yeah.
But I guess we can kind of chuckle about it now. But it was bad at the time. I know it was. I've been through a lot of that myself. So here you come up on release. And so this brings us to the point where we're really interested, Sean, in how you got yourself together, how you got yourself on your feet after going through that experience, because the people listening to this show, that's what they're going through right now. So talk to us about the steps you took to get yourself together. You've been very successful since you left prison, and I know you can't come back. You're banned from the U.S. for life, right? You were deported.
Yeah.
But you've been successful. You've written books and so forth. Sean, tell us about the mental process of getting yourself together after leaving prison.
Okay. There were multiple forces at work as I tried to turn incarceration into the educational opportunity for lifetime. One of the things that was the lifeblood of my rehabilitation was reading over 1,000 books in just under 6 years, including a lot of the original texts in philosophy and psychology. Mm-hmm. Now, that was really powerful in tandem with a psychotherapist I ended up with in the prison after the jail, who was into neuroscience and Eastern philosophy and a holistic approach, because a lot of the doctors were just experimenting on the prisoners with the latest psychotropic medication. But this guy was a good guy. He was the odd one out. So I clicked with him, and he said, look, Sean, it's great that you're reading all these books, but is there stuff in there you can apply to your life? You know, bring write some stuff down, bring some quotes in, mm-hmm. and let's discuss them. And he made me examine my life in the context of all this stuff I was learning. And he said, basically, I'd been self-medicating for PTSD. I'd almost got beaten to death by some drunks when I was a teenager. They were kicking my car and yelling at me, and I thought it was brave to stand up to them. They got me on the floor, started kicking me in the head. One pulled out an iron bar, smashed me in the face, knocking pieces of my teeth out. They ended up just leaving me for dead in a pool of blood. And after that, I had this anxiety whereby I wouldn't go out and talk to women in clubs, wouldn't go up and dance, too self-conscious, mm-hmm. wouldn't talk to strangers. But I took ecstasy when the rave scene began, and all my stress and tension melted away. So the therapist said, we've got to get to the root cause of your drug addiction. And he believes that this pivotal moment in my life was this factor, because I didn't think that I was an interesting enough person to be around for over 10 years then if I wasn't on drugs. So he also gave me the tools, once we'd identified this source of anxiety, to deal with it. He said, Sean, look, most of the things people worry about, they never even actually happen. It's just a waste of mental energy. And your brain has an internal pharmacy. So when you're stressed out, your brain is releasing the bad drugs, the cortisol, which damage your immune system and shorten your lifespan. He said when you're positive and happy, your brain is releasing the positive drugs, the endorphins, which boost your immune system, and happy people live up to 10 years longer than miserable, stressed out people. Mm-hmm. So putting all this in the context, he continued it and he said, it's even worse than that, because if you hang out with negative people, your brain starts to mirror theirs and fire off these unhealthy chemicals. So in prison, I tried to surround myself with the 10% from the 10% of people who weren't taking drugs. And there's a group of people in prison called the Prison Intelligentsia. They are doing multiple degrees. They got so much time on their hands. They're sharing personal development books. So, I sat with those people and we traded these books and tried to help each other mm-hmm. mentally and spiritually. So he said, if you look back on your life, this is what Dr. O said, if you look back on your life, all the things you've ever worried about, most of them are small things. There's one or two major things. So when something does happen in your life, a good way to get over it is to look at the most stressful thing you've ever got through. So when something stresses me out now, I look back on prison. For example, a couple of months ago, I woke up and my internet service wasn't working. So it was a week. I was about to publish a book. I was passing files back and forth with my typesetter, and every hour the internet was down. I could feel my blood pressure rising. But I remember what Dr. O said: think about what you've got through in the past. Take a step back and breathe. And when you breathe, it calms the cascade of unhealthy chemicals. So I reminded myself, you know, I went 6 years without internet. Why mm-hmm. the hell am I getting stressed out about a couple of hours?
Mm-hmm.
And that totally got my stress level down. So this Dr. O, he gave me all these different tools to keep my anxiety at bay. I do yoga, mm-hmm. I do meditation,
mm-hmm.
and I just think combined, all this work over the years has helped me become more of a happy person.
Did you start the yoga and the meditation while you were incarcerated, or is that something you started when you got home?
My sister sent me a book called Yoga Made Easy when I was in the jail in the first year. Uh-huh. I hid it. I didn't want the gang members to see it, think I was assisting and start to pick on me. Yeah, but my sister, she kept on my back. She was like, have you tried it yet? So in the end, I thought, all right, to get her off my back, I've got to try it. I was so embarrassed, I waited until my cellmates were downstairs so no one could see me. I did a basic sequence of postures: forward bend, side bend, cat, dog, spinal twist. And at the end, I lay down flat on my back, corpse pose, and I felt all the stress and tension just melting out of my shoulders. And I said to myself, I used to take drugs to feel like this. You can actually mm-hmm. do this naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's taking drugs is a shortcut for happiness, and you've got all the side effects that you've got to bear over in the long run, which are quite serious. You know, I've lost a lot of friends to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But if you put the work in, yoga and meditation, I do, on a Sunday evening, I do a yin yoga class and I do a meditation. And I've come out there some nights feeling like I was almost on ecstasy. I've literally got stuck at a traffic light, smiling at the clouds, listening to some DJ Sasha with people beeping at me from behind saying, you know, get moving. I've come out of there so spaced out. So I think yoga and meditation are extremely powerful tools for dealing with anxiety and dealing with PTSD and stuff like that. The other thing is, to build resilience, prison helped me deal with tricky people. And I learned some techniques from, he was the head of the Italian mafia in our building at the time. And whenever someone was angry people are probably the hardest to deal with. Say an angry person ran into his cell and yelled, you know, my public defender didn't show up today, I'm going to smash someone. He would take whatever they were angry about and put it in front of the word rage. Just say, look, you've got public defender rage. Calm down. It will pass. So how could people use that in their everyday life? You know, in this country, I say to people, you've got Brexit rage. You know, so many people in this country were just about to pop their heart valves
right.
with stress over Brexit. Same with, you know, a lot of people in this country about to have heart attacks over Donald Trump.
Right.
I say, look, you've got Donald Trump rage. You know, it's not worth bothering about. There's far more important things to focus on.
Right.
And all this politics and all this news media stuff, it just sucks people in and it prevents them from achieving success. It puts them in a constant state of anxiety, which, you know, corporations feel is necessary for people to be constantly purchasing things.
Right. Yeah, you've got a lot of good ideas, and I think you've got you're hitting the nail on the head. Sean, what would be your message, if you could just sum up in maybe a couple of sentences, your message to ex-offenders as they're reintegrating, what would be your message to them today?
You know what? Before I got arrested, I thought prisoners were pedophiles, murderers, rapists. And I went into prison, and I saw it was the warehousing of society's most vulnerable people for private prisons to make profits off the back of them. $50,000 a year, taxpayers' money.
That's right.
Back then, almost 1 million arrests a year for weed in America. Not dealer's possession. So it gave me a new idea of what prisoners were. Prisoners, the average prisoner these days is a young person getting arrested with drugs.
Right.
So I would say to that person, I would say, look, you know, you've got to ask yourself, why are you choosing that lifestyle, the drugs lifestyle? You know, I understand from when I was a young person, the fast cash, the excitement, all that stuff. And I'd been through some things that had put me on that path that had made me want to take drugs and maybe want to go further down into that lifestyle. So if someone's getting into that lifestyle, they need to understand what could possibly come at them further down that road. Mm-hmm. They need to go deep inside themselves, take an inner journey to figure out why they're making those bad choices. Because if they want to succeed in life, scrambling their decision-making processes by doing drugs is just going to compound their problems. And the people in the prison, you know, the road of drug use is very long, and the people in the prison, they're almost at the end of that road of drug use. Two-thirds hepatitis C, yellow jaundice skin, teeth rotting out. Mm-hmm. And to save their own lives, they were told they needed to get off the drugs. And they were choosing to keep taking the drugs and die. That's how sad their situation was. Mm-hmm. So that young person with drugs needs to ask themselves, do they want to keep going down that road and ending up like those people? You know, and I hope, you know, that's certainly not the case. So mm-hmm. people think when they get out of prison, they're not going to get a job. They've got a criminal record. They're going to get back with their old friends. They're going to get back into the lifestyle. But you don't need to do that. You can choose different friends. Choose to hang around people who are successful. Learn from them. Get mentors. And, you know, have to just maintain mental discipline to stay on the right path.
Mm-hmm. How many books have you written?
Well, when I first got out, I concentrated on my own story. And my life story mm-hmm. is a trilogy. It's Party Time, Hard Time, and Prison Time. Mm-hmm. And I went from prison then over to the war on drugs. I've been deconstructing the war on drugs through action-packed stories. Mm-hmm. And Pablo Escobar was the first one, Beyond Narcos. That was an instant bestseller on Amazon. Mm-hmm. I've got my second one in the War on Drugs series. It's called American Made, Who Killed Barry Seal, Pablo mm-hmm. Escobar or George H.W. Bush. And that's about Barry Seal. And we've got a Hollywood movie starring Tom Cruise coming out about him in August in this country and September in your country.
Wow.
I also have a book called The Cali Cartel, Beyond Narcos. And that is has just been released this week. And that ties into Narcos Season 3, which is getting premiered on September 1st. And that features the Cali Cartel. I also did a charity project earlier this year. If anyone's watched Making a Murderer on Netflix, I've got a book out called Unmaking a Murderer, because I believe those guys are completely innocent. Mm-hmm. And Brendan Dassey, it just breaks my heart that he's in there. He's done nothing at all. Mm-hmm. No, not a shred of physical evidence against him. Mm-hmm. So the proceeds from that book, the profits from that book, half of it is going to Brendan Dassey and Stephen Avery, mm-hmm. and the other half is going to something I've set up, whereby I donate books to school kids and to prisoners.
Excellent.
And through that, in the last two years, through that, I've managed to donate 15,000 books.
Excellent, man. And you've got a new book coming out in 27 this year, right? Something about they're lying to us.
The fourth book in my War on Drugs series is called "We Are Being Lied To," mm-hmm. and it is four stories that interweave all the way through it. Also exposing all the lies about the U.S. government, about the war on drugs and the racism, and how it was all, you know, it all stems from protecting certain corporate interests. I mean, even now, the Partnership for Drug Free America is financed by alcohol, tobacco, and big pharma.
Right.
So they just don't want competition from weed and stuff like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Man, you've done a lot of cool stuff, and you're certainly a bright spot. And Sean, you're somebody for us to look at and to say, hey, you know, there is hope. And Sean, I want to tell you congratulations, first of all, for your success. And since your incarceration, and I want you to tell everybody where they can go and get your books and how they can find out more about you. Where can they go on the internet for all that?
Oh, thanks, Rodney. I really appreciate that. And to anyone else getting out of prison, I didn't just get out of prison. I wasn't immediately successful. You know, I've been writing for almost 10 years since my release, and it was only last year I actually got my first international bestseller, the Pablo Escobar book. Mm-hmm. It took that long, but, you know, I'm the kind of person who will stay disciplined and stay on that track. If anyone is interested in all of my social media, I'm on all of the platforms. All of my books are available worldwide on Amazon. You just got to put my name in on any of those platforms, and it's my Sean is spelled S-H-A-U-N, uh-huh. and Atwood is spelled A-T-T-W-O-O-D.
Excellent. Sean, thank you so much for being on the Journey of Hope today. We appreciate it.
appreciate you having me on, Rodney. I look forward to you posting this and sharing it on my social media.
We'll do it, and we'll be right back after this. We're going to take another quick break. I'm Rodney Mathers, and you're on the Journey of Hope. Sure love to get email from you. You can always catch me at mathersrodney@yahoo.com, mathersrodney @yahoo.com. Let me know how you're doing. Thank my special guest today, Sean Atwood, and I want to remind you that if God is for you, who can be against you? We'll see you next time right here on the Journey of Hope.